Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. This is the show where we invite three smart people into the studio to talk about the week's news or a big idea. Today, it's a roundtabler's choice with a twist. I've asked three guests who work in medicine and healthcare to bring a big idea to the table, something that intrigues them about where medicine is headed. And then we're all going to talk about their ideas, and each one of our guests will have a chance at that. As you're listening to the conversation here, if you work in the medical field, I'd love to hear your thoughts via social media. You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Susan Wolfe is a professor of law, medicine, and public policy at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back. Good to see you, Susan.
Thanks, Carrie.
Shay Mandel is with us. He's CEO of Medical Alley. Welcome, Shay. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Carrie.
And Dr. Joseph Leach is an oncologist with Minnesota Oncology and director of oncology and cancer research for Allina. And may I call you Joe?
That would be great. Thanks.
Welcome. It's really good to have you here. And even though you're the newbie on the roundtable, I am going to start with you because I understand that you've recently been to a conference that pointed out something that that you've been thinking about quite a bit, and that's how often cost was mentioned.
Yeah, you know, so I'm a medical oncologist, and so right. I treat cancer. And we have lots of conferences, of course, talking about cancer care. There's a big conference, sort of our biggest conference, called ASCO, which is actually in May in Chicago every year. And usually ASCO is a great conference. We're talking about medical breakthroughs, what's coming in treatment of cancer. This year was a very different tone. Literally every talk used the term value, which really, as a cancer doctor, is something that we've not really thought of when we think about treatments. But over and over again, this message of what is the value, not just what is the p-value or statistical benefit of this treatment, but what is really the value to society and the patient for these treatments that we're developing.
Are those two very different answers? What's the value to society and what's the value to individual patients?
Very different. And I think we're just starting to come to grips with that. So I'll give an example of a drug that was actually just approved, and this is really timely because we've seen approvals of drug treatments for cancer like we've never seen before. There were 13 new oncology drugs approved just in the past 3 months, which is unprecedented. So one of the drugs that has been recently approved is a drug for treatment of some very difficult-to-treat cancers like stomach cancer, for which we haven't had very good treatments for. And the benchmark for getting a drug approved traditionally is a benefit, usually in survival, that's statistically significant, meaning that there was an improvement in survival that could be shown with statistics. But the survival was about 4 weeks. And so this drug is about $100,000 a year. So it's statistically valuable, but is it really valuable? Is that additional benefit really valuable to the patient and society, given the costs of healthcare now?
So when your colleagues are now bringing up value, what does that tell you about what has changed in your field and in healthcare at large?
It really has changed, especially the way I practice, the way I think about the conversations with patients. I would always tell my patients, and I still do this, the most important thing as your doctor is that I will do everything I can to improve your health and extend your life and meet whatever your goals are. But now, you know, as the cost of healthcare, especially in cancer, which is becoming a huge healthcare burden, as those costs are spiraling out of control, it's really important for patients to understand, well, there is this drug that is going to buy a little bit of time. It will have the burden of more side effects. And this is how much it really costs. It's not how much you're going to pay for it. Your insurance is going to pay the burden of this. But I think once people see really what the difference is and really what the cost is, I've more and more had patients say, yeah, I agree, that's really not of value to me, and let's not do that.
Even if, again, as you emphasize, you're probably not going to pay the bill for this. Somebody else, the healthcare system at large, is going to pay for the bill for this.
That's right. You know, and so we have insulated all of us who have health insurance from the actual cost of care. And that's really changing. Everyone's got larger deductibles. And this conversation at a national level of the cost of healthcare, everyone understands now. But it really is important that we factor when we talk about value in healthcare, it's not just how long you're going to live. And so the other thing that I think we've gotten much better about is what's important to you. And it's not always living absolutely as long as possible. And so that's coming into the conversation a lot more.
Susan Shea, what do you hear in this?
Well, I think there's an enormous shift underway that's even bigger toward partnering with patients, partnering with research participants, being transparent, much more transparent than we've been in the past, about the research, about the treatment. Cost is a piece of it. What's the burden going to be to you and to your family in terms of really dealing with this? In fact, the shift is so important, Carrie, that I think we're even seeing the rise of citizen science. People themselves who have conditions, sometimes very rare conditions, or conditions that aren't well handled by current medical care, using social media and other avenues to reach out to each other, form communities, actively engage with physicians, with researchers, and start to control more of the agenda in terms of what's going to be paid for, what's going to be the focus of research. An area that I'm very involved in is precision medicine. And you know that in the President's State of the Union address this week, actually within the first 2 minutes, he mentioned precision medicine.
Right.
A year ago, it was a big deal. Trumpets blaring. He was announcing it. In the intervening year, there's been an enormous amount of work at NIH and elsewhere to get this thing up and running. And what's so amazing about it is its commitment, not just to talk to patients and be engaged in that sense and the kind of beautiful transparency that Joe talked about, but actually to say to patients, you collect some of this data. Use your mobile devices. Use your phone. We're going to feed it all in. Total transparency. You'll see all your data. You'll see all your results. Making that actually work in practice is going to be a heck of a trick. But this is a seismic shift in the way we think about the involvement of healthcare and research with the people actually struggling with disease.
Shea, what occurs to you about what Joe said?
Well, I agree with the seismic shift concept. For sure. I think there's two pieces. I think the healthcare, quote, system, unquote, has not really been a system. Actually, as a result in value as a driver around healthcare, I think we're actually sort of getting a system together for the first time. And as Dr. Wolf points out, that system is truly expanding. So it's not just physicians, hospital administrators, insurance companies, but the patient playing a completely different role. I think the great challenge, and so the big idea around collaboration, which I think will be ultimately the solution to this problem, the big challenge is what's the definition of value? So Dr. Leach looks at this from the perspective both of his patients and he as an oncologist. The manufacturers of drugs, devices, diagnostics are trying to define value. Hospital administrators are trying to define value in CMS and the FDA. And so while I think everybody's wanting to move in the same direction, the value definition is illusory at this point. And so coming up with, well, is it clinical benefit? Is it cost cutting? If I create a little clinical benefit, but a little cost cutting, and am I in the right, you know, sort of ratio, or is it all about cost or all about clinical benefit? And so I think it requires doctors, patients, the federal government, payers, providers, manufacturers to have a bigger conversation together about how we define that and get there.
What happens when you're in the middle of what Shea says is at the moment not an alignment on how we would define value in the system? What happens to you in that?
Well, that really is the question. What does value mean? And it depends on who you talk to, right? If you are the person who's dealing with a bad disease like cancer, what's valuable to you may be very different to someone who is thinking about it in an abstract way. And so we don't have good metrics for it. You know, a lot of other health systems try to put a dollar definition, you know, quality adjusted life years, those kinds of things. But I think it's a much bigger problem to define it than just putting it in dollar terms. So.
Because if you're a pharmaceutical company and you've got a drug available that allows somebody to live for another 4 weeks, you've spent a lot of time and money to bring that to market. You want it to be used. You hear conversations that Dr. Leach has with his patients where they say, I don't know if that's the upside. I hear how those two players would be defining what value is quite differently.
And they're, but defining it just within the context of that sort of one-to-one analysis.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
You know, we define value every day as individuals. Do I want to pay more for, let's say, an Apple product or a Microsoft product or whatever? And there's value that we make individual decisions about. But now you're talking about something systemic. So is a drug going to work better for one patient or the other? You know, what decisions is the physician making, both in terms of advising a patient? But Dr. Leach, you know, as you know, hospital administrators are taking lots of decisions about product options in many cases, orthopedics and others, out of the physician's hands. You used to have 7 options for treating a patient. Now you've got 2 product options, and that's about bundling prices and lowering costs. So the complexity of the system in terms of being able to make a value decision and the multiple definitions can be mind-boggling.
Susan, what were you going to say?
Well, I think we are focusing more on things like the cost of drugs, the cost of chemotherapeutics, some bad actors in that world that have jacked those prices way up. So we need to look upstream, too, to question whether this really is the cost that ought to be assigned. But I think this bigger issue of engaging with patients about value and kind of navigating what you were saying, Carrie, the difference between how we might as a society or even as a healthcare plan value an intervention versus an individual patient, this is actually an old problem. This is a problem. I've done a lot of work on end-of-life care, and even 10, 20 years ago, we were talking about this question of what about the patient who wants everything at the end of life? What about the patient who says, yeah, I get it, Dr. Leach. It's going to cost all this money. I do want that 4 weeks. And I don't want to write that person off. I mean, I would hope that the physician will have a long conversation with that patient. It may or may not be practical, but we have been talking about things like limits and rationing and allocation for quite some time. They raise very tough ethical issues.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtabler's choice focused on healthcare. I asked all of our roundtablers to come in with a big idea to throw into the middle of the table, and you can hear us talking about it. Dr. Joseph Leach is with us. He's an oncologist with Minnesota Oncology and with Allina Health. Susan Wolf here, a professor of law, medicine, and public policy at the University of Minnesota. And Shay Mandel, CEO of Medical Alley. Am I right that you have cost on your mind as well? What's your big idea, Shay?
Absolutely. I think the big idea at this point really is about how we solve this value question.
Okay.
And again, cost is a part of it. You know, as Dr. Wolf mentions, you know, you don't want to write off those end of life people. And so we're certainly, you know, the opposite of an advocate for that type of rationing. So I think, you know, the big idea is where as a system or society do we begin to look at how we might implement solutions? And so, for example, our companies, device companies, diagnostics, drug companies, mm-hmm. et cetera, you know, we look at large disease states. So not that last 4 week period of time around something like cancer, for example, but how do we manage things like diabetes? How do we implement solutions over a longer period of time? But it also brings into play that personal, that patient component of them having more transparency in terms of information and behavioral change. And is that where we get to go to be able to change the value quotient to both have healthier people but be able to afford the more expensive treatments that really have an impact on a smaller population?
So your question today is more about managing chronic care costs and
yeah. and is that prospectively the solution that
yeah.
you know, our members can bring, I think, to the larger healthcare problems.
What do you think the answer is?
I think certainly. Again, I think the collaboration piece is really critical. But, you know, part of what we're seeing, and Dr. Leach mentioned specifically an oncology drug, but whether it's drugs or devices, I mean, we're seeing advancements moving at rapid speed. So areas like neuromodulation, which I know you and I have talked about before, I think has a real opportunity to have an impact on things like diabetes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. And so we do see great opportunities for the work that manufacturers are doing to play a huge role in value and cost cutting in the healthcare system.
What kinds of questions come to mind about that?
Well, I would say it's not all bad, right? And so there's great hope. And so this example that I gave is sort of an extreme of the old paradigm. The old paradigm is you take a shotgun approach. You use a drug that's a very blunt tool, treat everyone as if they're identical, which of course they're not. And then you get this median survival. But within that, there are people who derive great benefit and then some who get no benefit. And so, as Susan mentioned, precision medicine, especially in my field, is, I mean, really one of the great hopes. If we can identify which patients benefit from which treatments and bring them together, this value question goes away because the treatments work so well, there's no question that they're worthwhile. And we're not having patients undergo ineffective therapies for which they're only getting the toxicity and none of the benefits. We also need bigger breakthroughs. And in my field, sort of the game changer that is arriving and is, I think, going to change the way we approach cancer in the future is immunotherapy. This is a treatment that has now been approved for several tumors that we never thought of for immunotherapy, things like lung cancer. And they not only improve length of life, sometimes substantially, but at virtually no toxicity. So better quality of life, better length of life, even though they're expensive, clearly worthwhile.
I want to make sure I understand what you mean by immunotherapy. Is that really activating your own immune system?
Absolutely. So we're really in the infancy of understanding how this works. The drugs that are out there now and approved by the FDA, and we're using them in clinic every day, basically prevent the cancer from hiding. So a cancer like lung cancer, we never thought the immune system really played a role. I mean, there was always this theory that the immune system should be able to fight cancer, but we never saw good signals that that happened in solid tumors like that. It turns out that many lung cancers can literally cloak themselves by expressing a protein that makes our immune system think they're part of us.
Wow.
So this treatment literally just hides that protein, our immune system, with no stimulation. We're not doing anything to rev up the immune system, does its job and recognizes the cancer. And in some of our clinical trials, we're seeing patients who should be long gone, who basically are in remission now with literally no side effects. If we can get breakthroughs like that, this value discussion goes away. I mean, these treatments are clearly worthwhile. We need to focus on those kinds of treatments and less on toxic treatments that have minimal impact on patients. And really, research is the way to get there.
You know, it's really interesting to hear you say we need bigger breakthroughs, because to the outsider, it seems like every other day we're seeing some kind of headline about the latest breakthrough. But you're saying the weight and the meaning of those breakthroughs is not significant enough, many of them.
Well, so a lot of times when you hear about a breakthrough in the news, it's a couple of patients, it's some animals.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
the way the media kind of reports
exactly.
That. I get that.
It's exciting, but most of those things don't really translate into benefit for broad, you know, ranges of patients. This is real. So these breakthroughs are affecting people every day now. And the exciting thing is we barely understand this. We're going to improve on this over time. So research, which is something, you know, that's a big part of my job, is still really important. It's easy to get cynical about it, but we will not have better health, longer life, all the things that we want for all of us and our loved ones without more research.
What occurs to both of you from that?
I think Joe's totally right. I look at this optimistically, actually, Carrie, particularly now that Congress passed a budget with a lot more money for NIH to fund research.
More power to them.
More finally. Power to them, because big breakthroughs like immunotherapy for cancer, like what we're learning about genomics, that's the stuff that fundamentally reorganizes a lot in our understanding of disease and the therapeutic possibilities, and also how to avoid disease. How to prevent disease. So, you know, now the federal government is putting together this precision medicine initiative that I mentioned. That's the biggest genomics and other omics, proteomics, all the omics analyses project we've ever done in this country. Recruiting a million people. You're going to be able to just volunteer, or through a healthcare organization, you'll be able to volunteer. It's going to be amazing. 1 million people following them prospectively. There'll be a bunch of questions asked about what Joe was talking about in terms of what kind of responder are you to what drugs? So we can get out of this business of, you know, your doc says to you, well, I'm going to prescribe this drug. About a third of people have this bad reaction. A third of people don't respond at all. And a third of people, it's fantastic. And we'll see which you are. You know, we'll run the experiment empirically. The goal is to get away from that using things like pharmacogenomics, you know, a genomic or other analyses of who are you and what are you going to respond to, so that it's the people, it's the third who will respond who get it. And we are going to spare the third who are going to have terrible reactions, as well as the third who would just be wasting their time and wasting collective money on the whole thing. That's a vision of how we are going to individualize medicine. That's the precision part of precision medicine, so that it's not quite so scattershot. We really have a sense of what are you at risk for? What are you going to respond to? That's where we're aiming. And we want to power it now through fast analyses of huge data sets. 1 million is a lot of people. Another really crucial part of this is 1 million diverse people.
I want to talk about that when we when we get to your big idea.
Okay.
Hang on that, because I was reading some of the stuff you've been writing about that. Shay, a thought about how we took up your idea.
I'm certainly hopeful as well, and I think I would agree with Dr. Leach. I mean, we can accelerate breakthroughs without question.
Meaning the industry that you represent?
Doctors, patients, practically where the rubber meets the road, NIH funding has been increased. The R&D tax credit has been made permanent. Medical device tax was suspended, putting more dollars in. You knew I was going to bring that
up. Yes, and I was going to bring that
21st
up.
Century cure. So the opportunity is there. Dr. Leach mentioned if we solve these problems, the value question goes away. I actually disagree with that, not with where he's headed, but the value question is always a part of this. So, you know, when we look at what things cost, then the question is, I mean, you will see more innovation over the next couple of years based on those decisions made at the public policy level that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
If tomorrow we do go down the road of rationing and that $100,000 treatment isn't going to be paid for, then the next $100,000 treatment won't, the billions of dollars needed to develop it won't be invested. So at the basic level, NIH funding academic research, basic research, we're starting to see advancements in terms of that investment, which will create more breakthroughs. But we've still got to get them in the hands of doctors. And we've still got to get them to patients. And so how value shakes out will impact how quickly those get accelerated.
I have to say, you make me a little squirmy when we use the word rationing.
Right.
And you used it too, Joe, I think.
Oh, I don't think I said that word.
If it happens.
Because I think it's a loaded term. What I hear you describing is people making informed, not being told, well, you can't have this, even if you think it's worth 4 weeks extra of your life. I mean,
So conversations where we tell people we're not going to give them a treatment, that is not happening. And
that's rationing, isn't it?
And we're not doing
that. We're not doing that.
Not yet. I mean, you could see us headed there, but not
yet. Susan begs to differ.
Well, I got to say, Joe, so I went to the doctor Monday and she prescribed a bunch of things. And then I went to Walgreens and Walgreens said, we are not so sure this one is on the formulary. I didn't want to even hear what it would cost me if it wasn't on the formulary. And if you were in any way worried about money, and aren't we all worried about money, effectively, that's rationing. If it's not on the formulary and I can't pay some astronomical amount for this, I'm going to go back to the doctor and say, I guess I can't have it.
When I think about rationing, I think of the scenario that you talked about. So one of the questions that we as doctors need to ask more than we have in the past, frankly, is what matters to you? Not what's the matter with you, but what matters to you.
Mm-hmm.
If what matters to you, I've got a patient right now, we're having this conversation. There's nothing I'm going to be able to do to turn her cancer around. And so I ask this question. Is what matters to you the most how long you live or how well you live? Now, for most people, it's both. But for some people, how long I live vastly trumps how well I live at
really?
All costs.
At all costs.
At all costs.
Huh.
And for this woman, that is absolutely the case. I mean, she made it very clear, I'm willing to go through any toxicity if it will extend my length of life.
Wow.
Now, that's not a value decision that I would make, but that's her decision. And so as her oncologist, if I have treatments that could extend her life, it's clear what she wants. That's what I will provide her, assuming your insurance covers it. I don't know that it's always going to be that way. And so that ultimate autonomy that we give to patients that we all want, we never want to think that we're going to enter a conversation with a doctor who we turn to give us what we want in terms of our decisions about health, that there would be anything else that would enter that relationship. I don't think it is in a fundamental way right now, but you could envision that could change.
But Shay, you threw the word out there, I think, deliberately. Why?
Yeah, well, you know, as Dr. Wolf mentions, I mean, there's sort of practical rationing, as she said, which is, you know, you go to pick up a prescription and your insurance won't cover it. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a complex system. And so whether it's the individual saying, well, it's going to be $150, not the $15 that the other one, because my insurance doesn't cover it, or whether we fast forward to a world where we have IPAB fully implemented and we're making individual big decisions. I mean, there's no question that this conversation about money matters, because whether a patient wants to live longer...
But I think it should, don't you?
Absolutely. So whether a patient wants to live longer or better is a decision they and the doctor get to make. But if insurance won't cover that product, or if that product isn't on the market in the U.S., but it's available someplace else, I mean, that's an entirely different conversation, and that's what we're dealing with.
So let me add a word that I know is on our minds, which is cost effectiveness. So it's important, I think, Carrie, to look at this not just as cost, but also what do you get for that? It kind of circles back to what you were saying, Joe, about value. Now we have a whole methodology called cost effectiveness research to try to compare different treatment options, not just to ask, so which one costs more, but really for the value you get, which can be tough to measure. It may not just be extra weeks.
Right.
Extra weeks, what kind of weeks? You know?
This is the quality of life.
This is the quality of life
of
piece of it.
Yeah.
So it's a complex method. But now we see PCORI and others funding cost effectiveness research so we can really get data like that. So I think the whole conversation that used to just be rationing, oh my God, that costs too much, we're not going to fund it, has gotten much more sophisticated. What do you get for that?
And that's all right, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And that has to, exactly what you said is, I think, the change that we're seeing. It's not just a measure of how long you live, it's how well you live. And so when we look at clinical trials we're doing in cancer right now, the measures that we look for always were, how long do we keep the cancer under control? What's the risk of the cancer coming back? How long do you live? Now a fundamental piece of the research is quality of life assessments. We're constantly surveying our patients. What's your quality of life on this treatment versus another treatment? And if there's an improvement in survival, but the cost in terms of your quality of life is significantly worse, that's a different value assessment. So if the treatment that lets me live longer and better, like immunotherapy, which clearly does that, versus a treatment where I live longer, but I feel like I'm living longer because every day is a lot more miserable, that may not be as valuable to me.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a Friday Roundtabler's Choice, and we're talking about healthcare. Susan Wolf has come in to join us. She's the professor of law, medicine, and public policy at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Joseph Leach is with us. He's a cancer researcher at Allina Health, and Shay Mandel with us, CEO of Medical Alley. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation. We'll hear Susan Wolf on the big idea that she's brought to the table.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Two marine helicopters collided off the Hawaiian island of Oahu last night. The Coast Guard says the crash happened just before midnight, and each aircraft had six people on board. The Coast Guard says a debris field has been spotted two miles off coast. There's no word of any survivors. Several hundred people gathered today near the Jakarta Starbucks cafe that was targeted in yesterday's deadly terrorism attack. Some people held up banners saying, "We are not afraid." Many held flowers and placed them near the spot where a bomb exploded. Two civilians and all five attackers were killed. Police have arrested three people they believe are linked to those attacks. Islamic extremist rebels claim to have killed dozens of soldiers at an African Union base in Somalia. The troops are helping fight extremists from the Al-Shabaab group. The militants say they killed at least 63 Kenyan soldiers from the multinational force. The Kenyan military says the militants attacked Somali troops at the base. Only one more Republican presidential debate is scheduled before the Iowa caucuses. That debate later this month is in Des Moines. Last night, the most popular of the GOP contenders gathered in South Carolina to blast Democrat Hillary Clinton as well as each other. The Obama administration is expected today to announce a moratorium on any new major coal leases on federal lands. Companies will still be able to mine the coal reserves that are already under lease. And stocks are plummeting on Wall Street this morning. At last look, the Dow was down about 340 points. The price of oil sank below $30 a barrel today. More news ahead on NPR News. The time is 9:37.
Later on All Things Considered, the Guthrie's new artistic director debuts with a play he's directed before to rave reviews.
I have rarely sat in a theater watching a Shakespeare play where everyone around me is crying, and that happens in Pericles every time I saw it.
That and all the news starting at 3.
Support for this program comes from the McKnight Foundation, driving sustainable solutions to help the Midwest be a leader in advancing a clean energy economy. Online at McKnight.org.
Programming is supported by MacPhail Music for Life, lessons designed for adults 55 plus. You can make music this new year in a group or individual class. More information and registration at MacPhail.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a roundtabler's choice about big ideas and health. If you work in the medical field, love to hear your thoughts about the conversation so far. You can get to me on social media. Tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Susan Wolf with us from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Joe Leach is an oncologist with Minnesota Oncology and Director of Oncology and Cancer Research for Allina, and Shay Mandel, CEO of Medical Alley. Okay, Susan, spotlight on you. What have you been thinking about among the very many, many interesting things you think about every day?
I've been thinking about precision medicine, about genomics, and how it's really reorganizing how we think about disease and our treatment options. I've been thinking about new models emerging for how we dig into this, understand it, research, and implement it. There's a lot of emphasis now, rightly, on translational research.
What does that mean?
It's code, in a way, for moving quickly to translate research discoveries into actual clinical use and therapeutic benefit. The timeline for doing this has been shockingly long. If you look at what our pharmaceutical companies say about how long R&D, much less moving something all the way into real clinical implementation, takes years, years, years. And there's been an enormous effort to really understand that process. Where are the barriers? What's hanging this thing up? And how can we move much more quickly? A lot of our institutions now, including the University of Minnesota, have federally funded clinical and translational science institutes with significant funding to study where are the roadblocks and to move things much more quickly along. This is a big NIH initiative. And there's some very interesting things emerging about partnering in the way we talked about earlier, with patients themselves, saying, well, you collect the data. We'll wire your phone. We'll wire your Fitbit. Let's, you know, use computer power. Let's plow this into enormous databases. Let's make it very transparent. Let's change the way we do research. So the whole thing goes much more quickly in a much more transparent way. let's also re-understand how this works. It isn't linear. It isn't like the old-fashioned idea of, okay, now over here we're doing research and everybody's, you know, in labs. And then we understand it, done. Now we move it into clinical use. Instead, it kind of loops back. Think about genomics. Okay, we've understood now a lot about the genomics of breast and ovarian cancer. We even understand not just the genomics of your own risk for that, you know, BRCA1 and 2 and other genes involved in that. Now it's routine, as Joe will tell us, to analyze the tumor itself, analyze its genetics. What is going to kill it? What's it going to prevent micrometastases seeding in the body, which would make for a much worse diagnosis? So we do genomic analysis of the person herself or himself. We do genomic analysis of the solid tumor, very well integrated into clinical care. That's kind of unusual. There are a lot of other areas of oncology and medicine where it's early days. We need to set up these feedback loops. So you can understand enough so that you start to move in other forms of cancer, for example, and other diseases, some of the genomics in, and then you go, oops, now we're looking at a different population. What the heck is that variant? What is it doing? Up, loop back into research. So our whole picture of how this is happening turns out to be much more nuanced, more complicated. I love the idea of partnering with patients for speed. Now, I've got to say, some of this is the product of patient advocacy we saw around AIDS, and we've definitely seen around breast cancer. Trying to say to the Food and Drug Administration, too, and our regulators, you guys are stuck in the mud. You have got to pick up speed, too. One thing we haven't talked about at all with all of the issues we've raised is the big challenge this raises for the Food and Drug Administration and other regulators. They are scrambling.
What does that mean for your industry, Shay?
Well, you know, I mentioned, so there is more FDA funding. Dr. Wolf and I were actually talking about this before. I mean, you know, as we've always said, and I think industry, patients, everybody agrees that the FDA has an impossible job, right? So they are, you know, they are pushed to be aggressive and approve therapies because patients want them and the academic community and industry are developing them. And as soon as something happens, and we're talking about therapy, so something is always going to happen. It is impossible to create zero risk when you're dealing with drugs, devices, surgery, physicians, researchers, impossible. So something's going to happen, and then the FDA clamps up. So, you know, as Dr. Wolf mentions, we need to see an FDA that is able to continue to have talent that's on the leading edge of research, as well as experience in how you go through a process with industry and academia to approve products, modern technologies, but also really looks at that risk profile. What are patients willing to accept? What does safe and efficacy mean in today's environment where certain patients might be willing to take more risk?
Joe,
and what does that look like?
I wonder what your experience tells you about that.
It really depends on where you're at with your disease. So when we talk about clinical trials in humans, we talk about different phases. So phase one trials are often first in human treatments. There's a drug that looks very promising in animal models. We need some volunteers to find out what happens with them when we give it to a living patient. We know that the purpose of those studies is not to determine how effective they are, but really to find out what dose someone can tolerate, what kinds of side effects. If you look at someone with advanced cancer, their willingness to participate in a study where they don't even know what the risks are, frankly, is very high. And so I think it depends on how serious the disease is. We talk about informed consent, and that's really important as researchers. Patients who are participating in a study have to understand what they're signing up for. The more serious your illness, the less you really care, and frankly, probably the less carefully you read these sometimes 20-page documents. So,
Susan, a question about the databases that you're talking about. How, I guess I think of this as cross-pollination. How much information gets exchanged beyond the silo of breast and ovarian cancer? I mean, do researchers get the information about what may be happening with colon cancer that may prove important or influential in the way they're treating breast and ovarian cancer? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. I think there is a problem, Carrie. You're right to ask about it because of silo databases. And there's been a call for how do we break those silos down and get really free information sharing. Something like the federally funded Precision Medicine Initiative, the idea is, the heck with it, we're going to create one big database and for all comers, so that the breast and ovarian cancer people can look at what the pancreatic cancer people are finding. And, you know, this is so crucial because it turns out that a lot of these genes are pleiotropic.
Which means
they do more than one thing. They are important for more than one cancer or even beyond cancer. We, you know, through genomics, we've re-understood cancer as a pathway disease. It can be not so much to do with my breast in a way, but something about a tumor suppressor gene upstream is messed up. And so that could express as breast cancer. It could express somewhere else. So it's actually crucial that you're able to look at the full pathway of these genes. Now, I mean, these folks can read the literature and talk to each other, but sharing these databases robustly is very important. But the databases have a problem. Most of the genomic data we've got in this country was collected from people of Northern European descent. It's not a diverse database. So the databases we've got now really are at risk of recreating healthcare disparities at the genomic level. Article and editorial, very important, just came out in JAMA last week demonstrating this problem. What they did in that study was they knew there were some genes, two particular genes, that in patients who had cardiovascular disease were problematic. Then they went out and looked at a bigger population of healthy people to say, great, if we can just validate that those are risk genes and or genes associated with disease that hasn't been spotted yet and diagnosed in these people, gold. It didn't work. And so it turns out we need to understand more about those genes. They don't seem to be clear markers of risk and disease. But one thing the article said is we've got an even bigger problem, which is if you look at the few patients where it did seem to be correlated with something, they were patients who were white. They were patients whose, you know, rough population groups are better reflected in our database. Red alert. Urgently, we have to have a diverse database.
I read something you wrote about this in Stat News. I think it was last spring. And I think you had just had a genetic screening done or something. And you said, you'd had your genome sequenced. And you wrote, quote, "A small handful of variants were reported to me as potentially harmful, but most of them made no sense given my health history, complete lack of symptoms, and family history." And then you added, again, with this through this lens of who's in the databases, "the wisdom of communicating highly uncertain information to patients is debatable." Well, what do you do about this?
It's a huge debate. So, yes, I had my whole genome sequenced, partly because, you know, I study this stuff for a living. I thought, let's try it on me. Let's see what it's actually like.
I remember
like.
It was offered to me, too, and I was nervous to do that. So,
well, I was nervous, but I thought, you know, I can't just talk about it. I have to see what it looks like from the other side. And it didn't look good.
Really?
It didn't look good because I got this handful of variants where they said, well, this is the potentially bad stuff, and some of this should already be symptomatic. And I looked at it and I went, what? And this doesn't make sense. I'm not sure I believe it. And that's part of what the JAMA article said,
yeah,
too.
Right.
That a lot of this, even more sobering, was the news they had three or four different very, very, very good labs sequencing and interpreting. And they didn't agree with each other. A lot of this really is not ready for prime time. But it raises a big issue, which is if we're really going to partner with patients and even share with them the uncertain results, do we trust them not to be overwhelmed with anxiety, not to prematurely use the information I am really pro-transparency, but this is an open question.
Joe, you're a cancer researcher. How do you look at that?
Right. So first of all, the genomics issue is very germane to the work that we do. The pace of technologic change in this field has been unprecedented. You know, the Human Genome Project, you know, over 10 years ago took $3 billion a decade to sequence a human genome. I can now order a cancer genomic test of a huge panel of genes, have results back now on blood in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
So the ability for us to get this data at cost that's affordable has been amazing. Actionable is the question. So what do we do with all this data? And that's what we're struggling with. So in oncology, a big study that we're involved in, which is part of the Precision Medicine Initiative, is called the MATCH trial. So you're talking about if you see breakthroughs in breast cancer, what does it mean for colon cancer? We think that we should stop thinking about it as breast cancer and colon cancer, but start thinking about it as EGFR-mutated cancer or ROS1-mutated cancer. It's probably not the cell of origin. It's what's going on in the genes that's programming those cells to do what they do. So the idea with the MATCH trial is we're going to become agnostic as to the type of cancer. You're going to send us a piece of your tumor. We're going to send it to a very academic lab. MD Anderson's actually doing most of this work for us. We're going to run a full genome sequence of that, look for the genes that we think are important for cancer, then take that gene and use a medication that turns that gene off, many of which are still experimental, and find out if your cancer gets better. So it is the kind of study that we've needed that I congratulate the NCI for having the bravery and vision to try to do this study. But when you run genome studies on people, sometimes you find stuff that has nothing to do with what you're looking for, and now what do you do with it? And so one question that's come up ethically is, okay, what if we find a BRCA mutation in a man who has lung cancer?
That's the breast cancer
mutation.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got three daughters who may not want to know that they're destined to get breast cancer, may not want to meet with a doctor about having the breasts removed. So ethically, how do we deal with that? So we've actually are in the process of opening a companion trial looking at how do we deliver this information. Do people want to meet with a genetic counselor and even know about this? What happens when they get this information? And sometimes it's garbage. It's not really something that they were born with. So it raises all kinds of ethical issues, but incredibly exciting work.
Shay, do you have a sense of how you haven't had your genome sequence, or have you?
You know, my mother, so my family has the BRCA gene, and I have a daughter. And so my brother and I both do. And so neither one of us have had that done yet. And, you know, my daughter is 17, and it's something that literally I think about every day, my mom having passed away.
From breast cancer.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it is something that we think about every day. I think...
Can I just ask you?
Sure,
And if this is too personal, you tell
me. Yeah.
Is there a reason you have not had the genetic test done yet?
You know, my wife asked me that question, and my brother hasn't either. You know, and I think the answer is somewhere in your brain, this dilemma. Not if, because of course, you know, I have a cousin who's female who has had children and now electively had, you know, a lot of precautionary steps taken to deal with this gene. You know, if I don't have it, my daughter doesn't have it, right? If I do, there's a 50-50 chance. And I think she's 17. I think the question for me isn't whether or not to empower her with that information, but when is the right time to do it? And so I think for me, and I think my brother as well, his daughter's 10, it's a struggle of when do we need to know this, but also... You know, going to get a test today, for example, is go through a process of ensuring, you know, I have the letter from my aunt who tested positive for the test because my mother didn't until postmortem. And, you know, I have to take that and the insurance company has to approve it. And so I think, you know, this conversation, both about the ethics, the legal, whether we like it or not, it's far beyond patients and doctors. It's about therapies, and it's about, insurance companies, hospital administrators are all part of this equation. And so I know you're going to ask me, what am I thinking about? It is this community's ability, I think, to play a leadership role in how we look holistically at getting to some of these solutions. So, you know, unfortunately, before Dr. Leach can or Dr. Wolf can get us to a place ethically and clinically that we aspire to be, we need to be working together throughout the system to talk about the roles of different parts of the system. So,
and are you suggesting that isn't happening?
It's not happening. I'll say that the conversation about having conversations is starting to happen, but the healthcare system, and that's why, you know, my opening comment about there isn't really a system.
Yeah.
There are a lot of silos in a system. I think getting to a system is actually part of the solution. And I think because of the tight-knit nature of this community, because this community has world-leading bioethicists, oncologists, medical device manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, biotechnologists, research at the University of Minnesota and at Mayo Clinic, I think we actually have an opportunity here to have a conversation that includes leaders from those silos that we can demonstrate to the rest of this country about how we advance healthcare as Minnesota always has.
Where better to do that than the U of M?
And, you know, it's interesting, Carrie, we have spent a decade looking at the question Joe raises, which is return of results and incidental findings. You know, you were looking for a particular gene. Oops, there's the BRCA gene, or there's a long list. Should we offer that back too? There's a huge amount of work going on in that question around the country, a lot of it funded by NIH. We're doing some of it. And internationally, I will say that since we started this, and actually at the University of Minnesota, we were the first funded project by NIH on this incidental findings question. There has been a big shift. I think routinely now, anybody who's doing research has to clarify, even just to get IRB approval, what are they going to do about return of results and incidental finding? And I think state of the art in genetics now is to offer back to people at least the pathogenic, in other words, variants that are going to cause disease, predicted to cause disease, and actionable discoveries. Defining actionable is tricky. Is it just,
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But there's no time.
Is it just the stuff that the doc can use to really make a difference in your disease course, or does it include, for example, a gene that might be associated with greater risk of Alzheimer's? Not much docs can do about it right now, but it might really affect the way you live. And, Shay, there's a big conversation about kids. Your daughter's almost not a kid, but for right now at 17, she's a kid. And what are our obligations to them? So I think the ball has moved on this in terms of offering people this information, but not forcing it. If Shay and his family don't want to go that step yet, respecting that, but keeping that conversation going.
Hey, thank you all for an excellent roundtable conversation. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Thank you.